wanted to make. I want to think about another possibility. Let's say that indeed these dogs are mating. What if the dog actually gives birth here at ringside to a litter of, say, 10 or 12 Rottweilers? We could have as many as 2 or 3 dozen Rottweilers inside this kennel from Hellmatch.
That's just a small sample of what you guys have to look forward to this week in the second installment of Match Anatomy, which is coming up a little bit later on here on the podcast, episode 195 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, December 11th, 2011. I'm the Sala Monster. For those of you thinking I skipped the number, perhaps if you missed the midweek edition of the Sound Off, you did in fact miss episode 194. If you want to go back and take a listen to it, I give a full breakdown of Monday Night Raw from this past Monday night in South Florida, a show that some people loved and others not so much. I fell into the latter camp. Not a big fan of that show from Monday night. So go back and take a listen to that show if you want my thoughts on that. First, I want to clear up some confusion from something I posted on Twitter the other day. I am not getting married. A friend of mine is getting married next summer in Jamaica. And the ring that you saw belongs to her. The only ring in my future is the wrestling one that I watch on TV every week. So I just wanted to clear that up. Also, thanks to everyone who sent compliments on my John Laryngitis impersonation from Sound Off 194. It was kind of off the cuff. I got a lot of comments about that.
I am the WWE Executive Vice President of Talent Relations and the Interim Acting General Manager of Monday Night Raw.
God, I sound like I have emphysema. I should be walking around with an oxygen tank behind me. Anyway, I was at an independent wrestling show last night. I want to talk about this really quick here. The World of Unpredictable Wrestling in Brooklyn, New York. The world-famous Gleason's Gym. Of course, WUW, I've talked about it on occasion before. It's a promotion run by Johnny Rods, who is a WWE Hall of Famer. He's trained a lot of big stars, big names that you would recognize, the Dudleys. I think Taz trained with him as well, Bill DeMott, Matt Stryker. Just a whole bunch of different people. And in fact, they had used Johnny and his gym at Gleason's for a segment on Impact many years ago, I think, where Team 3D beat him up, if I remember correctly. So I'd been to a couple of shows. It's always a good time. I have a good friend who actually wrestles for them. He was on the show last night. I figured I would drop by, check it out. Had a lot of fun. And it's one of those things where, you know, I don't get a chance really to go out, I've said, as often as I used to the Ring of Honor shows when they come to New York, and I feel kind of bad about that. Sometimes money's tight, or I'm not in the mood to go. But anytime you go out and check out an indie wrestling show, and I guess ROH is kind of the, quote, higher end of the indies just because they have TV now, but more often than not, you're going to have a good time. There was actually a surprise on the show in that I was not aware of the fact that Damian Demento would be competing on the card. The same Damian Demento who wrestled against The Undertaker on the very first edition of Raw in the main event back in 1993 at the Manhattan Center. He came out. I took a look at him and I said, God, you know, this guy looks an awful lot like Damian Demento, figuring perhaps it was somebody who was dressed up like him. And then I just thought to myself, who in their right mind would dress like Damian Demento other than Damian Demento? In fact, it was him. So that was kind of interesting, a blast from the past there that I didn't expect. But, you know, overall, I had a really good time. I would encourage anybody, if you ever have an opportunity to check out, not just WUW, but really any independent, to get out and support them and check it out. And from what I understand, there may have been some familiar faces from WWE in the house scouting talent. I don't want to give away exactly who that was, but that's just what I was told. So, and also a shout out to Mr. James Alexander, the ring announcer for WUW, who gave the Sound Off another plug, another shout out at the show last night. Really appreciate that. So anyway, I want to spend a little bit of time here talking about this new WWE Network. There was some news that broke over the last week. There was actually an article in the Sports Business Daily on Monday, with some more specifics in the way of the WWE Network. Of course, on Raw Monday night, we were treated to our first full, I guess you can call it, trailer, for lack of a better term. This great music video that WWE put together with a bunch of highlights, just hyping the network and the network's first official show, which will be the WWE Legends House, which is going to be that reality, well, quote, reality show, where they take a bunch of WWE legends and stick them in a house. And they have already gone, and they put a logo together for the show. This thing is actually going to happen. And I said on 194 that I thought the video was actually very well put together. I thought it was really cool. And I would talk more about it on this show, so that's what we're going to do here. Some of the things that were mentioned in the Sports Business article Just a number of important bullet points here just to review really quickly. WWE is telling potential partners that the network is going to launch in 40 million homes to start. It's going to launch in 40 million homes. Now, I suppose it's possible. That seems like awfully lofty expectations on their part. 40 million is a very big number. I mean, just to put that in perspective, I believe major cable networks like ESPN and USA Network are available in give or take roughly 100 million homes domestically. You're talking about a brand new network starting up with not quite half, but pretty close to it. I just find that hard to believe. I think that's quite a goal for them to set for themselves. But that's what they're telling people. Comcast is working with WWE to help them clear cable and satellite systems. Now that Comcast has officially merged with NBC Universal, obviously WWE has a relationship with NBC Universal. And so it helps having a gigantic conglomerate like Comcast helping you out. The bottom line is the success or failure of this network is going to hinge upon one very important thing. We've said this all along, and that is the number of clearances. If they can't get that channel on some of the bigger cable companies in the country, for example, here in New York, are two of the biggest cable companies in the country. In fact, the biggest one, I believe, is Time Warner Cable. And so, for example, if you are a Manhattan resident, Manhattan, of course, if you are in New York City, just to give you an example, you likely have Time Warner Cable, unless you have satellite, and you have not had access to WWE Classics on Demand ever. That is still the biggest cable company after all these years. WWE has not been able to come to an agreement with Time Warner Cable. Now, thankfully, where I am, I have Cablevision. Cablevision is my cable provider. And it took a couple of years to get WWE Classics on there, too. It's very frustrating. But we do have it. But if you're a Time Warner subscriber, you don't. And so imagine, as difficult as it has been for WWE to get their on-demand channel on a company like Time Warner, I would have to imagine they're going to have to really clear some hurdles to get a full-blown cable channel on their service. So again, there's a lot of problems, potential problems that they have to deal with going forward. Now, if they can get cleared on some of these big cable companies and Comcast and Cox and Charter and all these different companies, then that's a huge hurdle for them to overcome. That'll be a big, big plus for the network. But so far, we have knowledge of zero clearances for a network that they hope to launch on WrestleMania Day. The intended launch date for this channel as of right now is April 1st, 2012, the same day as WrestleMania 28. There's a lot of people who work backstage for WWE right now shitting bricks right now because that launch date is not that far away. I mean, it really is right around the corner, and they have a whole bunch of positions that they haven't even filled yet. I mean, they don't even have a head of the network right now. I think Michelle Wilson, who works for the company, she's an executive there, is kind of filling that role right now. Not Kevin Dunn, which is kind of interesting, because Kevin Dunn's always been the go-to guy on stuff like this, and it almost seems like he's being eased out of the process here. But they don't even have a network head that they've hired. You know, basically, the article also says that they've contracted with a consulting group, which is working with WWE to help staff up to 200 positions for the network. Now, think about that. There's 200 positions or more with this network right now that are unfilled, and they want to launch this network in, what, 3 months? 4 months? It's not a long time. Also, the article mentions there is talk, according to, quote, sources, of sports team programming on the network as part of the aspect, I guess, they want to have some non-wrestling content on there. Well, so long as they don't strike a deal with Sportsnet New York to bring the New York Mets games over to the new network, then at least it has a chance of succeeding. That's a Mets knock, by the way, for those of you who don't know much about baseball. The Mets suck. And I'm a Mets fan, so I can get away with saying that. But, you know, this whole idea of having outside programming, sports programming on the network, I think is a horrible idea. First of all, what sport are you going to get to put on the network? You're going to get croquet, perhaps? You're going to get cricket? And that's not a knock on cricket. I know in some parts of the world, cricket is a premier sport. Not so much in this country. My point is, all the key sports, real sports, are locked into very lucrative long-term network television deals. NFL, MLB, NHL. What sports programming are they talking about? Perhaps bowling. Quite frankly, I'd rather watch the wrestlers bowl instead of watching professional bowlers bowl. But just the whole notion that they're looking at non-wrestling content scares me, because their track record of success, Vince McMahon's track record of doing things that don't involve pro wrestling, you know, he tried to start a bodybuilding federation, he tried to start a football league, his record is not exactly sterling. I mean, they even bought a hotel and casino many years ago. They were going to turn it into the WWE Hotel and Casino. It never even opened. I think they sold that property, actually. That was the old Debbie Reynolds Hotel and Casino in Vegas. I think they just ended up selling the property, and they actually made, a profit off it of about $1 million. But that was not their intent. They've always had these grand visions of being so much more than pro wrestling, and they always fall flat on their face. Well, now, you know, they're going all in with this network. And again, I don't want to see the network fail. I want it to be a success. And, I mean, look, at the end of the day, we can all bitch and moan about wrestling and how sometimes it sucks and this and that, and it's not as good as it used to be. But the fact is, we're all wrestling fans. You know, we want things to be good. We want things to be better. I don't want to see the network fail and then it somehow negatively impacts WWE, because as WWE goes, so goes wrestling. You know, and if this network really bombs and they pump millions of dollars into this network, it's not like WWE is going to go out of business, but it could affect them in a very bad way, which then has an effect on everybody else in the process. When I was growing up and I was a young kid, the idea of a 24-hour wrestling channel, I mean, was like a wet dream to a little kid. Are you kidding me? I mean, I would love to, back then, have had a 24-hour wrestling channel. I can come home from school, put the TV on, and just watch wrestling anytime I want to. To some degree, I kind of have that now with Classics on Demand. I don't watch it. It's kind of funny because I fought tooth and nail with my cable company to get that freaking channel years ago. And I finally got it, and I love it. And there's some great stuff on there. But I find that oftentimes I miss most of what they put on because it's a rotating kind of block of content. You know, it's on for a certain number of hours each month, and then it disappears. And for all the fighting I did to get this friggin' channel, and I talk about how much I love it, and I really do, most of the good stuff I end up not even watching because, you know, I'm older, I have work, I have other responsibilities, I just don't have time for it. But, you know, the reality is a 24-hour cable wrestling channel, to a lot of people even today, would be a fantastic idea. Imagine being able to put on, whether it's WWE, WCW, AWA, I mean, they're going to have all sorts of content on this channel. It's a pretty cool notion. You know, you can get too much of a good thing. You got to worry about that. But I don't want to see it fail. And when I hear that they're interested in doing, you know, they're going to do comedies, or they're going to branch out and do this, they're going to bring other sports to the network. The selling point for the WWE network, it's in the name. WWE stands for World Wrestling Entertainment. You cannot have a WWE network and put another sport on there. It doesn't make any sense, and it's not going to work. So I don't like that idea. I don't like hearing about that idea. I want them to, if they're going to do it, stick with what you know, and what you know is wrestling. Now, the most interesting aspect of this article, which we've heard before, is this notion. According to the article, most is the word they use. Most of WWE's pay-per-view programming would migrate to the network. The article does not specify whether they would air live or if there would be replays that ran after the pay-per-view broadcast. So to go back to the on-demand channel WWE has, about 3 or 4 months or so after a pay-per-view airs, that pay-per-view will then air on Classics On Demand. So, for example, you know, we just had Survivor Series. So my guess would be probably around February or March, Survivor Series would be airing on 24/7. The article doesn't state whether or not WWE is actually moving most of those B-shows to the network, and that's exclusively where they're going to air. Or again, if what they mean by that perhaps is a month or two after, you know, Extreme Rules, the pay-per-view will then air on the network. So nobody knows for sure. What seems to be the case, what people are speculating, what seems to be the best guess as to what this means is that maybe not right away, maybe it's not until 2013, I mean, who knows. Many of those B-show pay-per-views, Extreme Rules, Elimination Chamber, Hell in a Cell, Money in the Bank, TLC, all of those, will move to the network. And there'll be 3 or 4 main pay-per-views like the Royal Rumble, like WrestleMania, like SummerSlam. Interestingly enough, I haven't heard Survivor Series as one of them. And I know Vince McMahon has not looked at Survivor Series as being anything special because he hasn't made it anything special, except this year. They banked everything on the return of The Rock. Survivor Series, though, is not what it used to be. I'm not sure that they would consider that a major pay-per-view to keep on pay-per-view. I think you have to, just because, let's just say, hypothetically, you move all the B-shows to the network. You've got to space out your big pay-per-views over the course of the year. You know, you have the Rumble in January, you have WrestleMania in April, you get SummerSlam at the end of the summer. You got to have some buffer between SummerSlam and the Rumble, so it would make sense to keep Survivor Series on pay-per-view. But nobody knows for sure what's going on here. I personally am comfortable. I'm fine with the idea of moving the B-shows to the network. In a perfect world, we'd go back to the old way of having only four or five pay-per-views a year, because, I'm sorry, 13 shows is just way too many. You know, when WWE during the Attitude Era was at its apex and everything was cool and fresh and interesting and they had so many different stars. They had Austin, Rock, Triple H, Foley, Undertaker, Kane, Big Show, DX. They had a ton of stars. Jericho, everybody. You know, you could get away with doing a pay-per-view every month. You know, having 12 pay-per-views a year became the normal thing to do in the late 90s, the mid to late 90s. And you can get away with that. And I, you know, would gladly pay for those shows. You don't have those same stars today. You don't have the interest in buying a show every single month because they do such a piss-poor job of promoting those shows. And pay-per-views cost a lot more. You know, back then they were $30. I think, yeah, pretty sure they were $30. Then, of course, they moved up to $35. Now, forget about it. You're paying at least $10 to $20 more per month for these pay-per-views, depending on HD and standard definition and all that. They're going to lose money because the reason they're still doing the B shows, they make money off them. I think their break-even point is about $50,000 or $60,000. They make that much and they've already turned a profit now. It's no wonder why they still put these shows on. But these numbers are just trending downward and downward, and it's just so friggin' depressing. And these shows don't mean anything. You know, you have this TLC pay-per-view coming up next weekend. I don't know if they're going to blow off the feud. But they're finally giving Zack Ryder his U.S. Championship match that they've been building up for months now. And they should have done it at Survivor Series, and they didn't. And as I said on 194, if you didn't do it then, at least push it to a major show like the Rumble. But no, they're going to give it away at TLC, which I think is a mistake. Triple H and Kevin Nash, am I interested in seeing that match? Not particularly. It's not going to be a classic. Well, it could be a classic match, but for the wrong reasons. But still, it's a match you've been building up for months. It's one of the main feuds in WWE. I've had to sit through all these Triple H and Kevin Nash segments. There's got to be some sort of payoff, and you're giving this sledgehammer match away at TLC, which, you know what, hey, fine, give the match away at TLC. I mean, I'm probably not going to watch it. I'm sure some of you will, and you'll let me know what you think about it, but I just don't understand the logic in blowing off big matches like this on a pay-per-view that even the company, supposedly, realizes is not going to do very well. I guess the logic behind putting Triple H and Nash on TLC is that they hope it sells more pay-per-view buys. Does anybody listening to this right now honestly believe that by adding Triple H against Kevin Nash on that card, it's going to add more than 5,000 buys at the most? And even that probably is being generous. It's not a marquee. People don't see it as a marquee match. People didn't see it as a marquee match in 2003 when Triple H and Kevin Nash feuded last for the World Heavyweight Championship. It's now 8 years, almost 9 years later. My God, who would have thought Kevin Nash and Triple H, who would have thought Kevin Nash would still be wrestling 9 years later with the bad knees that he has? I mean, I guess good on the guy that he could still move around. I mean, granted, he moves a lot slower, but I don't know. The point is, these shows are pointless. They've lost any value they once had. They have these gimmick shows now because the whole point was, well, we'll gimmick the shows up and more people will buy them. Let's have an entire pay-per-view called Hell in a Cell. And we'll have two or three Hell in a Cell matches on the show, and we'll have double the number of people who order these pay-per-views. Guess what happened? Those numbers didn't double. Not even close. In fact, they're going down. Hell in a Cell is dead, thanks to what they did to that show. The one exception here, actually there's two exceptions. Elimination Chamber, I think, always does kind of well, although if I remember correctly, Elimination Chamber actually didn't do too well this year. Money in the Bank, it just so happens, there's been two Money in the Bank pay-per-views, and both Money in the Bank shows have been excellent. I mean, they've been some of the best pay-per-views WWE has ever done, not just because of the Money in the Bank matches, it's just a coincidence. You know, those cards clicked, there were a lot of great matches on both shows. Obviously, this year will be remembered for the main event, but I thought the Money in the Bank pay-per-view this year was one of the best pay-per-views that they've ever done. So what does that mean for the Money in the Bank name? I don't know. Could they do, you know, three in a row? Maybe. I just think they got lucky, quite frankly. You know, John Cena and CM Punk, they lucked into that match. That wasn't a Money in the Bank match, but it was a hell of a match. So moving those pay-per-views to the network, I think, is fine. I have no problem with that. The fewer pay-per-views that we have, the better, the more they're going to mean, the more money I really do think they're going to make off of them. The problem is that if you are going to move these B-shows entirely to the network, I can't see them doing that right away. But if that is the ultimate goal, you're going to need to get those 40 million plus clearances for this network. Otherwise, you know, you're going to have people who aren't even able to access these shows. And if you still spend hours each week on Raw and SmackDown building up pay-per-views that people can't even see, that's not a good situation to be in either. So again, getting clearances, it becomes the number one priority for this network. How you do that between now and April 1st, when as far as I know they have very few, if any, clearances, I don't know. I'll leave that up. Hey, they're the pros. I'll leave that in their hands. But as an outside observer looking in, based on everything we know and hearing the reports of people panicking behind the scenes and just thinking to the, in their heads, you know, Vince wants this thing to launch April 1st. There's no way in hell we're going to be ready to launch this thing on April 1st. I don't know. I do like the idea of pre- and post-game shows. I've advocated that before. I'm pretty sure that's one of the things I talked about when I did my WWE Business Rundown episode. I think that was episode 127. I've always been a big proponent of that. I know they've had things kind of like that on the pay-per-view pre-show channels, or they used to have those pre-show editions of Sunday Night Heat. That's not a real pre-show. I mean a real pre- and post-game show like you would see in sports, you know, in baseball or football. I think would be really cool to have for WWE. Apparently we're going to get that. I think that's a plus. So that's what we know right now about the network. It's still very limited in what we know. We know we're going to get Legends House. You know, I think was it Zack Ryder? Somebody joked around on Raw Monday night about making sure the Iron Sheik was in that house. And unfortunately, the Iron Sheik, he was, I believe several months ago, he was in a very bad auto accident with a couple of other people. And he had major surgery, I believe, on his ankles. And he's in pretty rough shape right now. From what I understand, he's in a recliner in his house, pretty much unable to leave that recliner. And he's already an older guy who is in pretty bad shape. So I don't know that Iron Sheik will be able to be part of that Legends house. Well, it would be entertaining as hell if he was. Put him and Sergeant Slaughter in a house together. Anyway, as we get more news and information on this new network, I'll talk about it here on the show. It's a fascinating thing. I mean, the fact that this is actually going to happen. And again, I don't know if it will succeed or fail. There's a lot of things they need to do to help get this thing off the ground. A lot of people have tried launching networks. Vince talked about this himself, I think, at the last stockholders meeting about how Oprah, you know, launched her own network. I mean, come on, this is Oprah we're talking about here, the most powerful woman in the world, probably. And her network, I think, so far has got to be considered a failure, at least initially it was. And Vince, you know, that was part of what Vince was talking about at the last stockholders meeting about how, well, you know, she kind of wasn't, it was, you know, wasn't focused on what brought her to the dance, and that's why it didn't work. So we're going to focus on what we do best, which is wrestling. And I was very happy to hear him say that. And then I hear this about how they want to bring other sports to the network, and I kind of am left scratching my head wondering which version of Vince McMahon said this, since obviously the guy is bipolar. I'm not quite sure what the hell this guy wants to do, but I guess we'll find out soon enough. I didn't get a chance to watch SmackDown this week, and I had been considering it, and I heard from a whole bunch of you complaining about how insufferable, absolutely intolerable Michael Cole was on the show, which is a shame, because I felt on some editions of Raw recently that his act was toned down quite a bit. And apparently he was back with a vengeance on SmackDown this week. And so I've decided I'm not even going to bother watching the show. But what I did hear was kind of interesting about Michael Cole's dig at Lillian Garcia. And there was an item I noticed on SEScoops.com today. Obviously, I mentioned on 194, Lillian is back with WWE. She is signed to go back on the road full-time as the new ring announcer for SmackDown, replacing poor Tony Chimmel. And apparently on SmackDown Friday night, obviously Cody Rhodes, you know, I did read the report on what happened. Cody Rhodes was all over the show on Friday night, which is great. I think more Cody is good. I think he's obviously working his way up the ladder in WWE, is very good. And kind of rained on Lillian's parade, her big return at the beginning of the show. Anyway, I guess there was a segment later in the show where she was dancing with Hornswoggle. And Michael Cole made the comment, he said, I wish these two would stop horsing around. Now, what's funny about this, obviously it's not funny, what's funny about the whole scenario is that if you go back and listen to the podcast I did during the week, I did this show, I did 194 on Wednesday, okay? So this was a full 2 days before SmackDown even aired on TV, at least here in this country. And I believe on that podcast I made a quip about wondering how long it would take until Triple H is on television calling Lillian Garcia a horseface and making horseface jokes. And lo and behold, 2 days later on SmackDown, Michael Cole is on commentary making horse jokes about Lillian Garcia. Didn't take very long. Didn't take very long at all. And you can put that squarely on Triple H because, as I mentioned, Triple H was running things backstage at Raw Monday night. Vince McMahon was in Afghanistan doing some tribute to the troop stuff. And I believe Triple H was also running the backstage area and the announcers and everything on SmackDown as well on Tuesday. So I have no doubt in my mind that that joke came from Triple H. And basically, it was a joke that goes back many years. You know, when she was in WWE for her first run, she was mercilessly made fun of many different times, both behind the scenes and also on TV, by Vince McMahon, Triple H, you know, JBL, about the fact that she has a horse-shaped face. And, you know, it's not a funny joke. I never found it funny. Quite frankly, I never saw it. I mean, people also would make horse jokes over the years about Mickey James, which I also thought was kind of stupid. I mean, I always thought Mickey was an attractive girl, but she also got made fun of the whole Piggy James angle and all that. It would not be the first time that WWE has gone out of its way to bully and harass its own performers just because they get shits and giggles out of it. And it didn't take very long at all for Lillian to come back to the company, and on her very first show back, they're already cracking horse jokes about her. And apparently on the same show, Michael Cole made another remark about Jim Ross. I think Josh Matthews at one point was talking about how Michael Cole talked out of both sides of his mouth. And that was the opportunity for Michael Cole to kind of butt in and make a joke about Jim Ross not knowing, you know, something wrong with his mouth, of course, because he has Bell's palsy and he can't open his mouth all the way. And be a star, everybody. This is the same company that wants you to remember that bullying is not acceptable. You must be a star. We have to see commercials about this every fucking week. And this is brought to you by the same company making horse face jokes about women on TV and talking about how fat they are and all this different stuff. And yeah, hypocrisy at its finest, courtesy of World Wrestling Entertainment. I can't say I'm surprised. I really am genuinely shocked, though, at how quickly. You know, I made that comment on Wednesday. I really didn't think it would take such a short period of time. But hey, WWE, they never cease to amaze me. And I find it funny that a guy like Triple H especially would take it upon himself to make fun of other people. And God knows Triple H has done plenty of that behind the scenes over the years. If you know, you always take what you read on the internet with a grain of salt. But after years and years, you hear stories, and even some wrestlers who used to work for the company have sometimes corroborated stories about politics and stuff backstage. And Triple H has been you know, known to poking fun at people before and even you know, kind of burying people in production meetings and such. God knows he's done it over the years with Chris Jericho, and especially when Jericho came back to the company that second time, the whole Save Us Y2J thing and the classic story of Triple H backstage once, you know, talking about how, oh, Jericho's here to save us, everybody. We need saving. And you know, he's also talked about Mick Foley a lot over the years. Even now, behind the scenes, he talks about how Foley's not tough and he's best used in segments like we saw Foley in on SmackDown, dressed up as Santa Claus looking like a fool, because Triple H just doesn't think Foley is tough. And I've always been amazed at Triple H's clear disdain for Mick Foley. I mean, Foley went out of his way on his way out, you know, when he was retiring that first time, to put Triple H over like $1 million when Triple H was first working his way up the ladder as the champion. And I've never understood why Triple H has always taken it upon himself to bash Foley. I never understood it. And I don't understand how a guy with such a big fucking nose could take it upon himself to make fun of, you know, Lillian Garcia looking like a horse. It's funny. You know, you look at a guy like Triple H, and again, one of the biggest schnozzes in sports entertainment, and this guy's going to pass judgment on how other people look. It's pathetic. If you didn't see Impact on Thursday night, I would highly recommend that you go back at least and check out the James Storm promo from the show. Obviously, James Storm and Kurt Angle are on a collision course for the next TNA pay-per-view coming up. And, you know, Kurt Angle was the one who James Storm defeated in 90 seconds to become the new World Heavyweight Champion. Then Bobby Roode, of course, screwed over his best friend, won the championship. And now Storm and Angle have been in a feud. And Storm came out on TV Thursday night and cut one of the best promos I've heard in wrestling in quite some time. And he called Kurt Angle out to the ring, and Kurt was Kurt. You know, he gave the usual Kurt Angle promo, very intense. You know, I'm number one, I'm the best wrestler in the world, this, that, and the other. And James Storm, you know, got right up in his face and said, listen, I know you're trying to intimidate me. And he rattled off this whole list of things that's happened to him ever since he was a kid, and his stepfather died, and his brothers, I think, were killed in an auto accident by a drunk driver, and he just had to put his dog down recently, and obviously he got screwed out of the world championship by his best friend, and he just looked Kurt Angle dead in the eyes with this just the most intense look and tone in his voice, and said, nothing that you can do can intimidate me. You don't scare me. And I just thought that his delivery here, this whole promo, was great. He didn't come out and do corny comedy and scripted bullshit, you know, trying to be funny. The only funny line here, which actually fit, it wasn't like it was bad comedy done for the sake of comedy. You know, there was one point where, Kurt Angle talked about the fact that he thinks about, you know, James Storm, I guess, for beating James Storm, you know, morning, noon, and night. And James Storm made a quip about how you think about me when you go to bed at night. That's disturbing. I actually thought that was kind of funny, but that was it. That was the only comedy in this entire segment. James Storm is a pissed-off person. Why is he pissed off? Hey, again, he's fallen on tough times. He got screwed out of the world championship. Kurt Angle attacked him from behind and tried to end his career, tried to concuss him, tried to put him back on the injury list. Kurt Angle said, look, I thought you would be out for 6 months. You came back in 3 weeks. Obviously, that's my mistake. I should have beaten you up even worse. And James Storm, like I said, got right up in Kurt Angle's face. Kurt Angle, one of the top stars in the company, and said, you don't scare me. I'm not intimidated by you. I'm going to beat you up at the next pay-per-view. And it's just such a stark contrast to what we've seen, especially on WWE TV. You look at a guy like John Cena, one of the biggest stars in the company. And we saw some of that intensity from John Cena on Raw Monday night. One of the few things I liked about the show was that very brief backstage segment when he beat Zack Ryder and went to confront Laurinaitis. And he just, I think Otunga was in the room. He ordered Otunga to leave, and he was just yelling and very angry and very upset about the fact that, you know, Zack Ryder wasn't going to get a U.S. title match. And in just those few seconds, as stupid as it was for Cena to then go ahead and give up his own title shot, which I thought was actually just fucking dumb. The intensity that Cena showed was really kind of cool, because we're not used to seeing John Cena that way. He always comes out, nothing bothers him, nothing affects him. He's won the world championship 10 times or 12 times. I guess it's 10 WWE titles, 12 titles overall. And it doesn't matter, because he knows that when he loses it, he's just going to get another shot and win it back. So why would anything bother him? He's always going to come out and smile and salute and crack really corny jokes every single week. This is what they script for him. This is what he says. Okay, I'll do it. No problem. It's for the kids. And you know what? Good for the kids. Sometimes it's not about what the kids want or what you think the kids should see. It's about what's good for business. It's about what makes the product better. And if you're locked in a bitter feud with somebody like John Cena and The Rock, and I don't mean to make this a WWE story here. I'm just using this as an example, from the other company. After all the shit that's been said about John Cena and the way that the fans have continued to turn on Cena, and The Rock at every turn has screwed him over. The Rock arguably screwed him out of the championship at WrestleMania this year against The Miz. He left him laying with a rock bottom at Madison Square Garden at the Survivor Series. And I thought that might be what makes the switch go off inside Cena. It looks like that's where the angle is going, especially after Piper's Pit, that eventually Cena will just snap. But I'm tired of waiting for it. And I'm tired of seeing John Cena come out every week and always be this happy-go-lucky, cheerful guy. I'm watching James Storm on Impact, and I'm saying, I want more of this guy. This is what I want to see. This is a guy that takes his shit seriously. This is a guy that's pissed off about something that happened to him. He got wronged. He got embarrassed. He got hurt. And now he's going to do something about it. And I thought this was fucking great. So if you didn't see this promo, I highly recommend you go on YouTube and check it out. I haven't watched all of Impact yet. What I saw was not offensive to me, I will say that. It wasn't, you know, it didn't blow me away or anything like that. Part of me feels like TNA right now is, based on what I've seen, is it's like weird holding pattern where it just feels like nothing big is really going on. But the show seemed to be more focused than they were when Russo was running everything. Now that Russo is only writing a little bit and Bruce Pritchard is kind of overseeing and giving the general direction of things, I don't think Bruce Pritchard is a booking genius by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, he's booked before, and it's not as though he blew people away. But it's so nice to have somebody else's vision, you know, in play here in TNA instead of the same, you know, idiot that's basically been running things now for years. I enjoyed this very much. I think it's worthwhile to look up the segment and check it out. One other item here to mention, Lita, former WWE diva Lita, was arrested, I believe on Friday it would have been, Friday or Saturday, I think it was Friday, in Georgia. She was charged with speeding and driving with a license that was either suspended or revoked. She was being held on $2,200 bond. I guess that breaks down to $1,100 for each charge. So it's almost a shame that Jeff Hardy already served his 10 days in jail and Matt Hardy posted bail, because otherwise we could have had a Team Extreme reunion behind bars. That would have been something. All right, let's get to Match Anatomy here. Let's get this over with. To the few people who made this suggestion to me, I put a curse on you and your family members. No, I'm kidding. I actually was kind of morbidly entertained by this, in case you couldn't figure it out from the clip I played at the beginning of the show. Match Anatomy this week takes a bit of a different turn. This is by no means a five-star classic, but it is a classic, granted for all the wrong reasons. Al Snow and the Big Boss Man, in the very first and to date only, and there's a reason for that, Kennel from Hell match from the WWF Unforgiven pay-per-view in 1999. I believe this pay-per-view actually was the last, I believe it was the last show that probably would have been written by Vince Russo. Russo either left right after this pay-per-view or right before. It was right around this time that him and Ed Ferrara jumped over to WCW, just for a little historical perspective there. But this was a show that personally I remember it for not a whole lot. There was the six-pack challenge main event, which featured, you know, Steve Austin was the guest enforcer, and, you know, The Rock was in it, Mankind, Undertaker was supposed to be in that match. And that was when Undertaker had to take time off. He got replaced by the British Bulldog. Undertaker came back many months later as the American Badass for the first time. But tucked away was another little gem on this show, and that would be the Kennel from Hell. To give a little bit of background on this match here, Al Snow and the Big Boss Man had one of the more entertaining feuds, to me personally, in WWE history. This was back during the days of the Hardcore Championship, and I don't know if the 24/7 rule, I don't think the 24/7 rule was in effect at this point. I think that came into play with Crash Holly. But Snow and the Boss Man had a lot of matches around that time in 99 that I always found very entertaining. I mean, at one point, I think Boss Man was part of the, maybe it was a triple threat that involved Hardcore Holly and Al Snow earlier that year, I think at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre show in February, where they brawled, literally brawled into the Mississippi River during one of the Hardcore title matches. I think Al Snow and the Boss Man had a Hardcore title match at SummerSlam that year that, if I remember correctly, spilled into the streets. And I think they went across the street to a bar, and they brawled in the bar. I love stuff like that. I just thought that was really cool. Lots of plunder, lots of carnage. I think it's kind of played out in 2011, but back then this stuff was exciting as all hell. And they were locked in a bitter feud, just a bitter rivalry that culminated with the Big Boss Man cooking Al Snow's pet chihuahua, Pepper. Basically, he made pepper steak out of Pepper and fed Pepper unknowingly to Al Snow in a hotel room. And this aired on television. Now, that's pretty low. Just when you thought Boss Man could not get any lower, you know, how much lower can you possibly get? Believe it or not, Boss Man would top this a couple of months later in his feud with the Big Boss Man, which was another entertaining feud that culminated in an equally horrible match. So Big Boss Man, as entertaining as he was, God rest his soul, when it came to having matches and he was put in the position to have a match with these people he was feuding with, he sucked. So in this match, the idea was that it was a combination of the old WWF blue bar wrought iron steel cage topped off by the Hell in a Cell. And Big Boss Man had already had a Hell in a Cell match, his first Hell in a Cell match, which was against The Undertaker earlier that year at WrestleMania. And that was one of the worst Hell in a Cell matches of all time. So here's Boss Man again in a match that involves the Cell. And the idea, why would you have both cages? Well, the idea was that they would bring a bunch of rabid Rottweilers to the ring. And these dogs were just vicious, killers. And they were going to be running in around inside the cage, basically between the Hell in a Cell and the ring. So in theory, anybody who got trapped in between the two cages, you know, outside the ring, could easily be killed. They could be mauled by these rabid dogs. So the version of this match that I happened to watch was from the Mick Foley Hard Knocks and Sheep Pops DVD. Mick Foley actually made it a point. He wanted Al Snow's match with the Boss Man as an extra on his DVD. For those of you who don't remember, Mick Foley and Al Snow were, maybe they still are, very good friends, but Mick Foley would rib Al Snow mercilessly. I mean, he, at any opportunity on television, in his book, his first book, I mean, he would take shots at Al Snow that, quite frankly, were sometimes very mean-spirited. And the whole point of putting this match on his DVD was because of how atrocious this match was. But the thing is, the match is voiced over by Foley and Kevin Kelly, the current Ring of Honor TV announcer, former WWE announcer. And at first, it was a little tough for me to discern whether or not they were going out of their way to be over the top. And by about the first, you know, after the first, like, 3 or 4 minutes of the match, it was obvious that they were going way over the top with the commentary. And it was great. This match was an epic fail on every conceivable level. It is entertaining in kind of a twisted, morbid sort of way. So at least you got that. It is entertaining in that respect, I will say that much. But for what they were trying to execute here, I mean, it just did not work. So we get a recap at the beginning of the match from Kevin Kelly, recapping the whole Al Snow Boss Man feud. You know, talks about the Pepper incident, which of course was a dark day in WWE history. I still remember when Al would bring that friggin' dog out to the ring, and as is the case with many dogs, in particular this particular breed of dog, they're always shaking. They always look like they're so terrified. They're always shaking. And Al would bring this dog to the ring. He was like an earlier version of Paris Hilton, you know, clutching this dog to his chest, bringing him to the ring, and this dog looked terrified to be in front of 15,000 people. So anyway, the dog was not here. He was dead. So Al is wearing an Al Snow shirt in this match. And Kevin Kelly makes a comment about how Al likely purchased this shirt at Kmart or perhaps some similar discount store. And they bring the dogs down to the ring maybe about a minute or two into the match. And these vicious dogs, one of whom, by the way, relieves himself upon entering the cage. Kevin Kelly makes a great comment at this point. He goes, the dog just sprayed to mark his territory, he says. The dogs came in, and let's just say the plan, as far as the dogs are concerned, well, things didn't quite go according to plan. Now, I can see where, in theory, this would be kind of an interesting concept for a match. I give them points for trying something different. You know, you can't fault them for trying something different. The dogs, in theory, should have been running around the cage. There were about, I think, 3 or 4 dogs. They should have been running around the cage, barking, trying to climb up into the cage, just looking like vicious killers. And these dogs, all throughout the match, were barking and felt that it was more entertaining, I guess, to be barking at each other and paying more attention to each other than to the match. And it really hurt the match in the process. I mean, realistically speaking, it killed the entire match because the whole point of the match was this element of danger, which clearly was not there. People were laughing. I mean, people, quite frankly, were quiet throughout the entire match. They did not know what to make of this. They were bored. They were confused. It just didn't work. And as Boss Man climbs the cage at one point to get in, this was early in the match. Boss Man is climbing the blue bar cage, trying to get away from the dogs down below. And Al Snow is keeping him at bay. You know, he's trying to prevent the Boss Man from finding safe harbor inside this steel cage. Meanwhile, Kevin Kelly on commentary starts shouting that the dogs could rip the Boss Man's legs off, he says. He could be left with just stumps, says Kevin Kelly. I laughed uproariously at that line. Stumps! And this was about the point of the match where if I wasn't sure whether or not they were being tongue-in-cheek, it was very obvious that they were being tongue-in-cheek at this point. And like I said, the dogs spent much of the match paying attention to anything other than Boss Man and Al Snow. At one point during the match, Al Snow is hanging from the cage, and he's forced to drop down to the ground, even though he clearly is trying not to, because, you know, again, these dogs are going to rip him apart. So Al Snow falls down, and he makes a mad dash to the other side, because in theory, these dogs should have chased after him once he hit the ground. Well, the dogs didn't chase after him. In fact, The dogs were, well, they had their backs turned to poor Al Snow at the time. But Snow runs away, and he just lunges at the Hell in a Cell and climbs up the cage really quickly in fear of the dogs, who are not anywhere close to where he is. And, it's just, the fans are just stunned into silence at this point by what they are witnessing. And the match just drags on and on, and they use, you know, weapons and plunder, and, you know, it didn't help that the commentary track that I listened to, they really were just making fun. They were ripping this match apart. They were ripping this match apart far more than the dogs would have been ripping apart poor Al Snow or the Big Boss Man. But I think it made the match perversely more entertaining in that respect. I think if I would have watched this match probably with JR and King on commentary, not that they were bad announcers, believe me, they're two of the best, but I don't know that I would have enjoyed this quite as much as I did here. Even so, this match was just beyond horrible. And it just goes on and on, and Snow makes his comeback. Finally, Al Snow is making a comeback later in the match. And the commentary is so over the top, it's just hilarious. You know, Foley is just losing his composure, talking about how Al Snow is fighting back for every person who's ever eaten their dog by accident. And, you know, at one point, Al Snow goes to the corner, and he's playing with the turnbuckle, or doing something in the corner. And Kevin Kelly says, "It appears one of the dogs has taken a superior position, shall we say, with a young female Rottweiler." And then, of course, you heard that clip I played at the beginning of the show. He theorized that, my God, what happens if, you know, this one dog humbles the other dog, and perhaps that dog will then give birth right there on the spot, because I didn't know that birth happened, you know, so quickly. And he could give birth to a whole litter of Rottweilers. We can have 20 or 30 of them, of these dangerous, deadly dogs running around on the outside of the ring. Of course, unfortunately, that didn't happen. And Al Snow does, at the end of the match, use head. And for those of you who were not wrestling fans back then, listening to me say that, you probably have very lewd thoughts in your head. No pun intended. Back in the day, Al Snow carried around a mannequin head. Really, what happened was Al Snow was in WWF for a few years. And he portrayed a bunch of different characters. There was one episode of Superstars, actually, many people may not know this, where Al Snow was a hired gun from Jim Cornette trying to take out the WWF champion Shawn Michaels. And he came on Superstars, as far as I know, just this one time, dressed up as Shinobi, the Black Ninja. Of course he lost. He was also known for being, you know, portraying the role of Leaf Cassidy, who was part of the New Rockers tag team with Marty Jannetty, and that went on for a while. And WWF at the time obviously had an existing agreement with ECW, which a lot of people knew, some people didn't know. And they sent Al Snow to go work for Paul Heyman in ECW with the idea that perhaps they would find something for him that would click. And wouldn't you know it, Paul Heyman actually found something that clicked. Al Snow started carrying around a mannequin head that he began talking to. And it had "Help Me" written on its forehead backwards. So it read like "Empla." And he just started talking to it and carrying it with him to the ring, and people started to take to it, and they had the gimmick where they would give foam, styrofoam heads to the crowd, and they would, there was one particular ECW show, the first time, when they just threw them at the ring and showered Al Snow in heads, and Al Snow became huge, hugely popular. So then, of course, Vince saw this and decided, well, we're going to bring him back to WWF so he can do his act here, and he got over. Al Snow had a great run with head. Al Snow got head, and it was the best thing that ever happened to him. And he brings the head out at the end of this match, to which Kevin Kelly says, "Yes, Boss Man gets head here at Unforgiven." And basically the match ended. I didn't even remember how this match was supposed to end. I don't remember them announcing it during the ring introductions. If they did, it may have been scrubbed over by the voiceovers here on this particular DVD. So I'm just wondering to myself, how the hell does this match end? There's no referee in the ring that I can remember. So obviously these guys aren't attempting pinfalls or submissions. I assume that they just perhaps had to escape the cell, but it was never made clear. Boss Man at one point used wire cutters to try to cut open the top roof of the Hell in a Cell, and that was earlier in the match. So towards the end, Boss Man climbed out, but Al Snow beat him to the punch. He climbed through the door, did everything in his power not to climb down to the floor, again, for fear of these dangerous dogs here that were busy humping themselves and wetting the floor. And Al Snow escapes the cell, wins the match, and the crowd cheered, and I think the only reason the crowd cheered was because they knew this fucking match was over. This was absolutely abominable. And I talked earlier about how Boss Man went on to have his feud with Big Show later in the year. And Big Show did some... I mean, Boss Man did some really nasty things to Big Show. I mean, you know, he hired a fake police officer to inform the Big Show on one episode of Raw that Big Show's dad had died. Which I believe Big Show's dad did die in storyline because they had the funeral. Big Show is at the funeral with his family. There just so happens to be a WWF camera filming this at the funeral. And that's when Boss Man came in. I think he was driving like an old Blues Brothers car, and he attacked the Big Show, beat him up at his dad's own funeral, and he proceeded to hook the casket to the back of the car and drive off with it. And that was the infamous scene where Big Show chased after the casket, jumped on the top of it as Big Show is dragging it through the cemetery, and Big Show kind of slides off the top of the casket. And, I mean, it was just incredible, incredible stuff. I think Boss Man broke into Big Show's mother's house in another skit and forced her on television to call her son a bastard and was crying her eyes out. And this was all great stuff. I say great in that I was immensely entertained by it. You know, Big Show, Boss Man had a great poem that he read on Raw once, which was actually really, really tasteless and really, really classless, but I still laughed at it. But when they had their match at the Armageddon pay-per-view that year, the only reason I would say that match was better than this one is because that match must have literally gone 3 minutes. And I'm not even joking when I say that. And 2.5 minutes of those 3 minutes consisted of Big Show laying on the floor on the outside after being beaten up by Boss Man. At least that match was, it's like ripping a Band-Aid off. You know, the quicker you do it, it'll be over with. But this match went on for like, oh God, like 10 or 12 minutes, which was 9 minutes too long. And again, I appreciate the fact that they tried something different. There's a reason we have never seen a Kennel from Hell match since then. And this would be the reason why. So yeah, this match sucked. Al Snow won. Nobody cared. They both bled. For what? I don't know. Wasn't a lot of blood, but still. Why you would put yourself through that type of abuse in this kind of match that meant nothing, I don't know. Yeah, the Dogs were going against the script on this particular show. And, well, this match, quite frankly, was for the Dogs. So that's Match Anatomy for this week. And I would suggest that perhaps next time we'll do a match a little bit better than this one. Although, again, all suggestions are welcome. I've got a request from you guys for some other pretty... let's just say that some of the matches that you guys are going to have me reviewing in the next couple of weeks, I may have to get to drinking before I do that. But it's entertaining all the same to look back on these matches. Hopefully it is for you as much as it is for me. Time for the mailbag and some shout-outs, which we'll get to along the way here for those people who have requested it or left a review in iTunes, which, again, I encourage you to do if you have not already done so. You can go into iTunes, leave a review with your thoughts on the show, or give it a star rating, so I'd appreciate that. And if you have questions for the Sound Off, as always, you can email me directly at thesolomonster, all one word, thesolomonster, at gmail.com. Sam Fines writes into the Sound Off here. Two questions relating to the WWE Network. One question here he asks, with the launch of the new network on the horizon, do you think we'll ever see a show consisting of taped house show matches and dark matches, resurrecting this sort of wrestling challenge type show? From a business standpoint, free unlimited programming, right? An interesting idea. Do I think they're going to do it? No, I don't think they're going to do it. If you take a look at the kind of matches they usually have at the house shows, it's usually preparatory, for lack of a better term, leading up to a pay-per-view. You know, they'll do Dolph Ziggler against Zack Ryder for the U.S. title on a house show. But yet, that's a match they haven't given away yet on TV. So I don't see them airing those sorts of matches on television, even if it is their own network. I could see them airing old shows. I mean, they used to have old Madison Square Garden Network shows. They even show them now on Classics on Demand. I assume they'll stop airing them on Classics on Demand at some point, much like those Legends roundtables, and just shift everything over to the network. Dark matches especially, I mean, some of the dark matches they put together, I cannot see them giving that away on TV. The whole purpose of a dark match, for example, when Raw goes off the air, SmackDown goes off the air, is just to give the fans a little something extra, you know, to send them home happy. And there's some big matches, too, and they just had a 41-man Battle Royal after Raw last week. It's not the sort of thing I see them airing on a new network. Second question here, I don't know if it's been addressed, but will all WWE programming be solely found on the new network when it launches, like Raw and SmackDown, or web shows like Superstars and NXT? Or will they still air on the cable/internet? No. I don't believe that... Well, I know for a fact Raw and SmackDown will not be airing on the new network. Now, if SmackDown or Raw were to lose their TV deal, then yes, I could see them airing on the network. But both shows, I think, are pretty... Especially Raw. Raw's locked into an agreement with USA Network until 2014. So unless Raw's ratings take an absolute nosedive and they somehow cancel the contract, which I don't even know if they could do, Raw's pretty much locked in. And WWE would not want Raw to be anywhere but USA Network. USA Network is consistently ranked the number one cable network in prime time. Usually they're neck and neck with ESPN of late, but typically they're number one. You get a lot more exposure on the USA Network than you would WWE. Again, even if they somehow launch their network with 40 million households having access to it, that still is a ridiculously small number compared to the number of homes that have USA. Why you would want to leave a real established cable channel just to put your number one show on your new cable station that isn't even cleared in most of the country, that wouldn't make any sense. Now, as far as something like Superstars and NXT, which do air internationally still, I believe, I could easily see those shows moving over to the new network. In fact, I would expect them to. If not right away, then definitely at some point. Brian Quick writes into the show, so I'll make his shout-out quick here. He's been a huge fan of the Sound-Off since he first heard it back in episode 98. I never miss one, even the interviews and the wild-haired spur-of-the-moment rages on a show. Well, thankfully, I haven't had one of those in a while. I often get very sad when I finish it because I know it's over. My son has even taken a liking to enjoying the Sound-Off, so I'm asking for two birthday wishes. Trenton, my son, who is 2 as of December 11th, and mine. I'll be 28 on the 16th. So, happy birthday to Brian and Trenton, both fans of the Sound-Off, father and son. That's kind of cool. Luis from Illinois writes in, is Vince McMahon scared of holding future WrestleManias in Canada as he will be even less likely to be able to control the crowd in terms of who he wants them to cheer? He's only held them in the Toronto Sky Dome and both resulted in better quality Hogan matches, perception-wise at least, due to the crowd. No, that has very little, I'm comfortable saying that has very little, if anything, to do with them not holding more WrestleManias in Canada. Quite frankly, they've held... they held more than one WrestleMania in Canada, like you said, in the same location, in fact. Sometimes you just have to spread it out a little bit. And they were at least at one point considering Toronto for WrestleMania this upcoming year in 2012, which tells me that there's at least a decent chance they could go to Canada next year instead, in 2013, and maybe at that point put people like Trish Stratus in the Hall of Fame. I know that was an idea at one point. When they got The Rock, they decided to move everything to Miami. That's the only reason WrestleMania is in Miami this year. But, you know, besides Canada, I mean, I've heard that potentially Dallas, you know, they've been to Texas a bunch of times, but usually it's Houston. I think Dallas and Toronto, I think, are the front runners for WrestleMania for 2013. Is he scared of holding them in Canada because of the crowd? No. If anything, it enhances the show. It is what it is. You know, they'll call the fans, you know, bizarro and all their usual bullshit that they would never think to do in New York. You know, I didn't hear them calling the New York fans like us bizarro fans at Survivor Series last month. But no, it has very little, if anything, to do. They're going to be back in Canada very soon. David Menigo writes in. He wants to know about Primo. Where is he? We've barely seen him on TV since his match with Sin Cara. Why hasn't he been on TV lately? He's a utility player. That's how they view him. You know, even he did his little turn. I think he's with Junico and Epico and whatever. And he plays a certain role on the show. He's not a big star. He means nothing to ratings, which is all that matters to them. It's not like the shows are suffering because of lack of Primo. He's a good worker. They use him where they can. They use him on Superstars and all that. He's a utility player. Nothing more, nothing less. Isaiah from Virginia writes in, what do you think about Gail Kim returning to TNA in general? Some people have criticized her for leaving TNA originally and going to WWE only because they waved more money in her face. Do you think that she was greedy for leaving or not? No, not at all. Absolutely not. I mean, Gail Kim did that little shoot interview that she did. I didn't pay the $12 to see it. I read transcripts and everything. And I remember when Gail Kim left TNA and went to WWE, hearing all the stories about how she was just devastated. You know, even with all the extra money she knew she would be making by going back to WWE, she didn't want to go there at all. She was quite content staying in TNA. She made a lot of friends in TNA in that dressing room. She helped, along with Awesome Kong, put that division, that Knockouts division, on the map. Quite frankly, many years ago when they were having those matches with each other. You know, it was a great time to be a fan of the TNA Knockouts division. It was a prosperous time. Their segments routinely did the highest rating on Impact each week. She did not want to leave, but she spoke personally with Dixie Carter and said to her, listen, the offer you're making me is just not sufficient. I need to be making more money than this. And TNA's the one that dropped the ball on that because they didn't see the value in her as a performer. If they did, they would have paid her a little bit more money. Even if it wasn't exactly what she was looking for, they could have probably made her a better offer. What that offer was, I don't know. I don't pretend to know. I just know that Gail Kim must have been really unhappy with it because she did not want to leave that company and go back to WWE. I remember when Gail Kim was first let go by WWE, it took everybody by surprise, including Gail Kim. Nobody can understand why Vince McMahon would let her go. It was quite a shock. So, of course, they had no problem taking her back, and yet they took her back, and what'd they do with her? They did absolutely nothing with her. They treated her like garbage, as they do with many of their divas. But here's a diva who could actually work, and they did nothing with her. And they brought Karma in, and you know, you could have had a reprisal of the great, awesome Kong-Gail Kim feud. No, ultimately, we found out Karma was not going to be able to stick around very long because she was with child, but still, even before that, it didn't look like they were going in that direction at all. So they had no plans for Gail Kim, and that's why Gail just kind of gave up. She didn't care anymore about that Battle Royal on TV where she eliminated herself, and she basically said, I want out. I quit. And they would not let her out of her contract, which is why it took her many months to be back on TV. They said, no, we're not going to let you just walk into TNA. We're going to let you sit at home. And when your contract expires, you can do whatever you want. And so Gail Kim went back to TNA, making what kind of money? I don't know. It was several years that passed between them. All I know is she needed to make a certain amount of money back then to support herself. And obviously she felt that she couldn't do that with what TNA offered her. Is that greed? Would anybody else listening to this show right now have done anything differently? I mean, maybe yes, but to me that would have been foolish. I mean, obviously if she was that dissatisfied with what they were offering her, sometimes even if you can live off that, it's a matter of pride. Gail Kim, I'm sure, much like any other person in wrestling, takes pride in their work. And she had every right to take pride in her work because, as I said, she helped put that division on the map. Routinely the highest rated segments on that show. And they weren't offering her what she felt she deserved. It was an insult to her. And she spoke directly with the president about it, and Dixie Carter wouldn't budge. She gave them every opportunity to keep her, and they basically spat in her face. So, she did what she had to do for herself. That's not greed, that's logic. That's what makes sense. This is not a question of you sold out. This is a question of you fucked up, directed at TNA. Leon from Orlando writes in with a question. His birthday was on December 6th. Would be cool if he can get a shout out. Happy birthday, Leon. His question is, do I think it would be better if Rock goes Hollywood Rock? Because at this point, his Cena vs. Rock feud seems very uninspired to the point where I forgot what they're fighting about. Cena seems to be cool while The Rock is the only one showing any intensity. You hit the nail right on the head there. That really is quite the summation of this feud so far. You know, Cena comes out, nothing bothers him. He's cool. Cool like the breeze, right? And The Rock comes out and he's always intense. I mean, The Rock is always fired up when he comes out. He's snorting, he's spitting. I mean, he looks like he's about to burst at the seams. And it's quite a dichotomy there. And as far as Rock going Hollywood Rock, I mean, people are still going to cheer him, I think, no matter what. But Hollywood Rock was a heel character. So essentially what you're saying is you want to turn The Rock heel in a feud that the fans have already turned John Cena heel. And I think that would make things worse at this point. Especially now, there's just a couple more months left until WrestleMania. After all these months of build-up, off and on, but still, I mean, this thing has been hyped up since February. All of a sudden, for Rock to go heel, it wouldn't make any sense. It wouldn't make any sense at all. As much as I love that Hollywood Rock character, it was the right time for it. It was perfect. You know, he wasn't going to be, you know, Austin wasn't going to go heel in that feud when they had their last match at WrestleMania 19. When Goldberg came in, Rock was a heel, intent on putting Goldberg over, so it worked. For Rock to go heel right now would not work. For Cena to go heel, you know, would it change things? It might, but I think the fans have already turned Cena heel, you know? Maybe if he started showing some intensity and showing some heelish tendencies, that would be kind of cool. But to turn Rock heel, I think, at this point would be a huge mistake. Bill Mitchell, a fine man, writes into the podcast here, prefacing Sound Off 194. Someone had asked about the WWF sex scandal from the early 90s. I talked about that at length, by the way, on episode 194 if you missed it. So that was part of the mailbag segment. You can go back and check that episode out. It was posted on Wednesday, for those of you who may have missed it. And Bill Mitchell references the Phil Donahue show that I talked about that had the likes of superstar Billy Graham, Bruno Sammartino, Barry Orton, Vince McMahon, among others. However, he noticed that Dave Meltzer was also part of the panel for that discussion. He was just curious Was this the start of McMahon not liking Meltzer and the Wrestling Observer, or does his disdain go back even further than that? He was just curious. Meltzer is he's one of the more respectable wrestling journalists out there, obviously. He's been writing about wrestling, God, probably since the late 70s, early 80s. And Meltzer was, in fact, with that fabulous mullet of his from back in the day, he was sandwiched in the middle of that panel on the Phil Donahue show. I guess they wanted some so-called wrestling experts on the show. So I believe John Arezzi, who was, I don't know if he, I think he might have promoted, and he also had a wrestling radio show back in the day, was kind of a heavy set guy. He was on the show. And Dave Meltzer was literally sitting right next to Vince McMahon. So all the more reason to go check out this Phil Donahue show on YouTube, because it's just awkward watching Vince McMahon sitting right next to Dave Meltzer. And Meltzer, to his credit, you know, he was fair about things, as he usually is. You know, he had some things to say to McMahon that McMahon, I'm sure, did not like, but he also came to McMahon's defense at certain points during the show when he felt he was being unfairly criticized. And I actually remember Meltzer on one of his radio shows a few years back commented on this and was asked about being on the Donahue show, and he kind of recounted his experience being on there. And how during one of the commercial breaks, Vince McMahon kind of turned to him and was, you know, just casually chatting with him and said, God, you know, I can't wait for this show to be over. And if you watch the show, you can understand the position that Vince was in. I can't believe Vince agreed to go on that show in the first place, you know, as public enemy number one. But I give him credit. He has brass balls for at least agreeing to go on there. But I'm sure he couldn't wait. He couldn't wait to get off that set. And I guess he had turned to Meltzer at one point and told him that and said, God, I can't wait to get out of here. So the thing about Vince is, I'm sure he always had a dislike for people like Meltzer and Wade Keller, you know, the wrestling journalists who would call him out on crap sometimes. But, you know, Vince back in the day had a pretty healthy relationship with people like that. I mean, him and Meltzer, for example, would talk on the phone quite a bit, sometimes for hours on end, and sometimes they would just talk about whatever. They would debate and argue back and forth about certain things. And Vince was a relatively open person when it came to so-called wrestling journalists up until, I think, around the time of the Attitude Era. And I think that was really when things stopped. And then around 2001, 2002, WWE, I guess, unofficially instituted this policy that there would no longer be any communication with wrestling websites and the wrestling media. You'll see wrestlers now go on certain shows that air, like on Sirius XM, like the Busted Open radio show or Arda Ocal show up in Canada and stuff like that. But when it comes to, like, wrestling, quote, dirt sheets and websites, they don't have any communication with them at all. They don't allow any of their talent to talk to them. It's one of the reasons why when people leave the company on bad terms, the first thing they usually do is go to those people to do interviews, because they can't do it when they're under contract with WWE. WWE cut those guys off pretty much completely about a decade ago. And they've stuck to their guns since then because they don't like them, because they call them out on their crap, you know? That's why they have a hatred, such a passionate hatred for people like Keller and Meltzer and all those types of people. But I agree. I mean, seeing him sitting there on the Donahue show right next to Vince is, it's kind of a trip, quite frankly, to see that. Ant writes into the Sound Off. Want to give him a quick shout-out here for leaving me a review in iTunes. He says, with all the talk of Chris Jericho possibly on his way back to WWE, I have a couple of questions for you. I'm guessing he will arrive in spectacular fashion to interrupt someone, like he did with The Rock in 99 and Randy Orton in 2007. Who do you think will get the Jericho treatment this time? If I had to take a guess, I'd say it probably would be CM Punk, and I think it would make for a hell of a TV segment. He also says here, his 2007 comeback, he interrupted Randy Orton, but was the original plan for it to be John Cena that Y2J would save us from? It seemed logical to be Cena, as Jericho lost his last match to him back in 2005 and then was fired by Eric Bischoff. Cena, however, got injured around that time, so did that change WWE's original plans? That's a really good question. I don't have an answer for you. I don't remember reading anything about Orton being the backup. And my guess would be no, only because they had to have known that when Jericho came back, he was going to be a babyface. And the fans cheered for him. They were really into him. And he put a lot of thought into his comeback and what he was going to look like and all these different things. And he came back. I mean, he came back as a babyface. So could he have come back as a babyface against Cena? Yeah, I guess it's possible. But it would be a little awkward, I think, for him to do that. It would make more sense for him to come back and kind of, quote, save us from a heel, which is what he did with Randy Orton. So my guess would be no, that was not the original plan, but I'm just guessing. I really don't know. I mean, it's a good point you bring up. I just don't know. Nissim writes into the sound off, wants to know which known wrestler had the most success wrestling abroad after he had already gained fame and success in the U.S. I'd have to think about that a little bit longer, but the first name that pops into my head is Stan Hansen. Stan Hansen, I don't know that you can call Stan Hansen a huge star in the U.S., but, you know, he competed in the U.S. He was, you know, in WCW for a time and, you know, left the company to go work in Japan, which is pretty much where he has stayed ever since. And he became a huge star. He became a legend in Japan. Just wrote a book, actually, that came out fairly recently that's been getting pretty good reviews, the Stan Hansen book. So he would probably be the premier person that would top my list. As far as who else, I'd have to give that some more thought, but I think Stan Hansen probably is the biggest. Andrew writes into the sound off here, with The Undertaker being in pretty poor health, should WWE put off his 20-0 match and wrestle until WrestleMania 30, or then if hell were to freeze over, you could get Sting to come in? Another Sting question. So Sting can come in and job to The Undertaker and get inducted into the Hall of Fame and have both men go out on a high note, assuming they could put on a good match. Undertaker may be in poor health overall, physically. He's obviously not what he used to be. He's hurting. He can do one match. Undertaker's going to be just fine. He's going to come back next month, probably, or in February. He's going to wrestle at WrestleMania against who, I don't know. I still think Randy Orton. I think there's a pretty good chance, but nobody knows who he's going to fight just yet. And he'll be fine, because if Undertaker can't wrestle one match a year, then Undertaker shouldn't be wrestling at all. And he could take as many years off as he wants to. The problem is he's already in his late 40s. So the longer he takes off, the older he's going to get. His body is not going to get any better. He's always talked about when he retires, he's going to need at least one, if not two, hip replacements. He may need some other replacements as well with his knees. Once he starts replacing all these different parts of his body, his career is over. He's done. He's finished. So, you know, holding him out another 2 years so he can maybe have a match against what? He'll be, let's see, Sting will be what, 55 years old at that point if he's still wrestling himself? Yeah, I would not do that. Undertaker's going to be just fine. He's going to wrestle at WrestleMania. The match with Sting would have been cool, but the time for it has come and gone. And I believe both guys will be in the Hall of Fame at some point, but not until they retire. Question here from my buddy Brass Tax, who writes in. He's noticed that Mark Henry is portrayed to look a lot weaker on Raw than he is on SmackDown. Do you think it's deliberate on WWE's part or just an oversight? No, I think it's a product of the writing on each show. You know, there's a reason that Raw will sometimes have good shows, and more often than not, they'll have shows that just make you want to rip your hair out of your head. SmackDown, by and large, I mean, SmackDown could have some pretty relatively boring shows, but for the most part, SmackDown's been pretty badass from what I've heard. I mean, I've seen, from the SmackDowns I've seen, I've enjoyed them. From the ones I've missed, I've read reviews that have said that in most cases, it's the better wrestling show of the week. The writing is more focused. There's less bullshit on SmackDown typically than Raw, with the exception of this week, of course, in Michael Cole's commentary. But I think it's just a byproduct of better, more focused writing on Fridays, or Tuesdays, I guess. Mark Henry is you know, this unstoppable monster more often than not on SmackDown, when he's not getting knocked out by the Big Show. And on Raw, he's just another guy who's in there with Punk and Cena, and they have a certain way of writing on Raw that's just infuriating sometimes, and very few people get over. So when Mark Henry goes over to that show, it's almost like, well, he may be the big dog on SmackDown, but let's just, you know, not that they go out of their way on purpose to beat him down, but I just think it's less of a priority on Raw to keep Mark Henry strong than it is to just put on the show that they're used to putting on, when it's most important to get Cena and Punk on there and do whatever it is that they usually do. I would keep Mark Henry very far away from Raw if I were in charge. And he wants just to put this out there. Wanted to know if I can give a special shout-out to somebody special, which I'm going to do. A hearty sound-off shout-out here to Sunita Kumar here on the sound-off. I don't know if she's listening or not, but if she is, that comes directly from Brass Tacks. He wanted me to mention that, so there you go. Mike Gallagher writes into the sound-off. I wonder if it's the same Gallagher that used to smash watermelons in his comedy act. I was wondering how wrestlers get under the ring without it being obvious to the crowd, in particular Big Show's WWE debut at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, as this was around the 2-hour, 45-minute point of a pay-per-view with an hour Sunday Night Heat beforehand. At what point would a 7-foot guy be able to get under a ring without being spotted? Sorry if I missed something stupid, and there is a stupendously simple answer. Not really. I mean, there's different ways of doing it. I always thought there was like a trap door under the ring, but it depends on the building, I suppose. There could be. Typically, there's no trap door. There's one of two things that happens. I think more often than not, there's a point in the show when, you know, the lights go dark, maybe they're showing a promo video up on the Titantron where people's, for the most part, people's direction is their attention is directed towards the screen, and somebody will be ushered maybe under a tarp, where they will somehow come down to the ring, run down to the ring, try to be as inconspicuous as possible, and just slide underneath. And you'll always have fans who spot it, but hopefully very few people do. In the case of the Big Show, I'm pretty sure he had to stay under there for the entire show. You have other instances where sometimes people just have to stay underneath the ring. They may have a headset, they may have a monitor underneath so they can kind of watch and hear what's going on. Maybe they get a cue from somebody at the exact moment they're supposed to either come up from under the ring or come out from underneath. But yes, sometimes people do have to just stay under the ring for the entire show. I'm pretty sure in the case of the Big Show, he probably had to stay under the ring. And the only reason I say that is because I don't remember the building that the St. Valentine's Day Massacre took place in. Like you said, it would have been very difficult to get Big Show under that ring without people noticing if they, let's say, rushed him down to ringside in between the, you know, last two matches. On the other hand, now that I think about it, I mean, Big Show having to lay underneath a ring for, you know, almost 3 hours probably isn't the most comfortable thing in the world. But sometimes that's how it's done. In the case of the Big Show, I don't know if he's ever commented on it maybe in an interview before, but that would be my best guess, because like you said, how else do you usher a 7-foot giant down to the ring without people noticing? And lastly here, I got two shout-outs I want to give to listeners of the podcast here. Got one from Zyko TV, if that is your real name. He left me a review in iTunes and is looking forward to episode 200, as I am. And also a shout-out here to Matthew Wilkerson, who is turning 14, actually. He's going to be celebrating a birthday, and also left a review in iTunes. Says, thanks for all the hard work that you put into the show. My father and I love listening to it. So yet again, father and son being brought together by the power of the sound off. How about that? If you have a review or a question or comment that you'd like to leave, a shout-out, for any particular reason, especially if you leave an iTunes review, that's the easiest way to get one. You can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/solemonster. I posted some fun photos and a brief video clip, actually, from the WUW Independent Show I attended last night. Some cool stuff. So if you haven't seen that, follow me on Twitter and check it out. You can follow me on Facebook as well. Friend me on there at facebook.com/thesolemonster. All one word, no spaces or underscores or anything like that. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, very easy. Type in Solemonster Sounds Off, it'll come right up, and you subscribe. Whenever there is a new show that goes up, you'll be among the first to get to listen to it. And I also will sometimes put episodes up on YouTube, whether it's a YouTube exclusive. Oftentimes, if Podbean is giving me problems, and let's hope to God that it doesn't give me problems when I'm done recording this, I will sometimes have no choice but to put the show on YouTube first until Podbean gets itself sorted out. So sometimes you'll get the sound off first on YouTube, so you can subscribe to my channel on there. My username is TheSolemonster, again, all one word. You can subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is growing by the day. Appreciate that. And if you're part of all these different things, then you are officially part of the Fantastic Four. Let me count here. Twitter is one, Facebook is two, iTunes, YouTube. Yep, that's Fantastic Four. And I remember saying something about a Fave 5. I think that's if I join Google Plus, which I'm still holding out on right now. But for now, it's still the Fantastic Four. So get in on that. And as always, I appreciate you guys more than words can express. You are the people that keep this show going. I very much appreciate your support. Please keep spreading the good word. We'll be back here on the air for episode 196 next weekend as we creep closer and closer to number 200. Very exciting stuff. That should be. I figure at this point that'll probably hit mid to late January is when we'll hit episode 200. So something to look forward to there. Until then, enjoy 3 hours of the Slammy Award Raw show this Monday night. And until next time, be well, stay safe. We'll be right back here next week with another episode of The Sound Off. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.